This is John Udell. The topic for today's podcast is the Extensible Business Reporting Language, or XBRL. I had a bit of an allergic reaction to XBRL when I first looked into it a couple of years ago. It seemed awfully complicated for something that aimed to become a broad-based worldwide standard for accounting and business reporting. But I wanted to revisit the topic and dig deeper, so when Brian DeLacy, a researcher turned XBRL entrepreneur, suggested that I talk with Charlie Hoffman, the CPA who invented XBRL, I jumped at the opportunity. We had a long but extremely informative conversation, so let's get to it. Hi, guys. I've been reviewing for the last couple of hours a whole bunch of things, including the column that I wrote in InfoWorld a while ago, which is how Brian got in touch with me, and the various correspondence that happened following that column. Let's see, what else have I done? I've reviewed a bunch of, well, Charlie, all of the documents that you pointed me to. I also went back and had a look at the spec again. And I went through the KPMG tutorial online, which I thought was quite well done. Brian, maybe you should tell me a little bit more about what it is that you're doing as a researcher at the Harvard Business School and how you came to be investigating XBRL. Why don't we start there?
So just for the record, John, and for Charlie's benefit as well, I am no longer at the Harvard Business School.
Okay.
I was and I have been for 8 years in a variety of different research capacities I've done. I have done different research projects in the standard setting arena,
okay, not
related to XBRL, but more in telecommunications and wireless technology. So somewhat familiar with the both, you know, domestic and international arenas of standard setting. What got me personally intrigued by it, and then I'll just pass it over to Charlie, is in XBRL specifically, is some research work that I was doing in the investment management and hedge fund
industry
in particular, which eventually led me to some of the work that was being done through the SEC and Chairman Cox's real advocacy for interactive data, which effectively, as I understand it, from sort of arose out of the realization of what XBRL in particular could do for financial reporting of the typical required statements that the SEC requires.
Yeah.
And that has certainly grown as it's expanded beyond just sort of, you know, reports from large companies into what might happen within the mutual fund industry in other areas.
Right.
And that, to me, then, is really just the tip of the iceberg, because as you look beneath the surface, you really get a feeling for what XBRL could do if the data at the point it's created and captured were captured in XBRL, rather than just sort of transposed at the point of reporting and SEC submissions. So that's what kept me interested in this space, and it just, as you peel back one layer of the onion, you see another where you see, wow, this just makes great intuitive sense. And so as I looked into this and sort of the roots of XBRL, of course, it didn't take too long to, Charlie's name popped up immediately as the guy who had the vision for this, long before it became what is really now an international phenomenon as I looked into it. You know, you've got, I had also done a pretty, significant line of research into stock exchanges.
Right.
And clearly they have been early adopters on an international front, whether it's in China or Korea or other countries, in utilizing XBRL to make the interaction that investors have with the exchanges and the companies a far more effective and efficient process.
Yeah, and those countries generally leading the U.S. in that regard, right?
I've tried to dig out more details in talking with people who actually have consulted with some of these foreign exchanges and reporters who have reported on these foreign exchanges. And it's very clear they require companies who list on their exchanges to submit and report their financial results in XBRL-enabled format, which makes it tremendously more accessible to investing publics if they can immediately see, for instance, the numbers, in U.S. domestic currency if they're U.S. investors, the tags and the line items of, revenue and expenses and in U.S. dollars with the labels in English. And XBRL makes all this possible to easily then, change the representation to yen. And what countries, Korea, I believe in particular, saw was that as soon as they sort of turned the switch on this, they suddenly had significantly higher rates of investment for from international investors, which makes a huge difference for their internal economy.
Right.
So to me, coming at it from a business perspective and a technology perspective, it just like made such intuitive sense. And Charlie was out there and sort of had, you know, painted the vision, at least as I understand it, and stuck with it to a point where it just, you know, it really is now an international phenomenon. So
That was good. Let me expand on that, but let me point something out first and correct me if I'm wrong. So John was asking about the state of XBRL. You were mentioning, Brian, that you are no longer at the Harvard Business School.
Right.
Okay, I believe that you left the Harvard Business School to create a company to take advantage of financial reporting,
yeah,
you know, if it existed in XBRL, or how would you characterize that? But the point is, you're asking about the state of XBRL, so here's a guy that had a nice little job at Harvard Business School, has quit that job in order to take advantage of what is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, exactly. The company that I formed is called Interactive Securities. What I see is a need. For instance, let me just give you a simple what if. If you have a personal portfolio, which you track on any of the number of very impressive financial sites, whether it's Yahoo or MSN or Quicken or, you know, you pick it. You put your portfolio, Morningstar, for, you know, sort of a fee-based site. You put your personal portfolio in there, and then, you know, if you want to sort of, if some other site has better tools that you'd like, you know, more or less what you need to do is you need to go and you need to re-enter your portfolio and all the tracking data and historical, you know, transactions that you've gone through and move it to that site. So one of the sort of the early visions I had was, look, what people should be able to do is they should be able to have control of their data, their portfolio,
mm-hmm,
and your portfolio should be portable. And XBRL makes that possible.
Right. Now
let's continue on.
Okay.
I want to make a point that fits into this.
Okay.
I want to make sure that I don't miss this opportunity. What I wanted to say is that I agree with Brian's vision. I see things a little bit differently, though. Because I'm an accountant. I come at things from the preparer perspective,
yep,
not from the analyst perspective,
yep,
not from the user perspective. So as rich a functionality set that Brian sees from the, I guess it would be called the analysis end, I see a rich set of functionality from the preparer's end. I mean, people always see the value to a regulator of having XBRL. They don't generally see the value to the preparers of using XBRL. And
mm-hmm,
frankly, in my view, the exchange of information is a byproduct. That may be a little bit of an overstatement.
No, I know what you mean by that. I do.
Okay. The point is that because you have the ability to express the semantic meaning of this information in a global standard format. Okay. The reason that people are going to do this is because it is in a global standard format. Because a lot of people will use it. This is very complicated stuff. It's very challenging to do a lot of these things, but you only do it once. Once it's done, many people can use it. And the exciting thing about XBRL for me from the very beginning is the use of the semantic meaning in the creation of financial information,
mm-hmm,
not the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. In accounting, there's a thing that's called a disclosure checklist. And I've got one sitting right over here, issued by the American Institute of CPAs. And basically, every, you know, big four CPA firm has their own disclosure checklist, and these things can be modified, but they're typically pieces of paper. They're 100 pages long, and you have, you know, accountants with green eye shades sitting down, and they look at the financials, and then they look at the questions, and then they go back and forth between the financials and the questions, and they check things off on this checklist.
Mm-hmm.
I can do the same thing by pressing a button in XBRL. And the benefit that I have is, number one, it's a lot faster. Number two, it's a lot more accurate for a number of reasons. First of all, because a computer's doing it, not a human. Humans make mistakes. Computers don't. Or if they make a mistake, they make the same mistake over and over again. The other thing is that accountant, because of the metadata that is expressed in XBRL taxonomies, that accountant is as smart as the accountant who created that taxonomy. That's a very powerful thing. Financial reporting these days is very, very complex. It's very difficult for accountants to keep up on all this complexity. But XBRL makes that easier because you can express it in taxonomies, and it is done one time, it is used globally. Again, a bit of an overstatement because there are actually two primary sets of financial reporting, international financial reporting and U.S. GAAP.
Mm-hmm. Which may or may not be merging?
It may not be the case that they merge, but they will converge. They are converging. There's a lot of effort going in to converging. And the reality is they may actually merge.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago, there were, I don't know, 50 or so sets of accounting standards. 49 of those have basically pretty much, they have gone away or are going away, and IFRS is taking their place.
Okay.
An example is Europe. Financial reporting of public companies. Every country in Europe had their own set of accounting standards. Now, all publicly listed companies are required, I believe, to report in IFRS.
Okay.
The U.S. is dominant. U.S. GAAP is dominant right now. However, the U.S. is losing some of its dominance in the capital markets, partially because of Sarbanes-Oxley. It's not quite as enticing to be a public company in the U.S. That has hurt the U.S. capital markets, as I understand it. Another reason is that things like what is going on in the European Union, where, again, 27 countries, I believe, are working together to create, basically, the ability to compete with the U.S. And they're moving up in their ability to compete. And the same thing is happening in other places, also in Asia. You've got Japan. I mean, I think there are 53 stock markets in the world. But the U.S., I mean, it's a target because they're in the leader. The leaders are always targets. So everybody else is trying to catch up, and they're being successful. Many of these other stock markets around the world are adopting XBRL or have adopted XBRL.
If we can kind of nail down what it means to adopt XBRL, since as in all of these kinds of cases, there are levels of adoption and levels of compliance and so forth. In XBRL, you've got XML syntax and business semantics. And the business semantics is expressed in the terms of taxonomies. So I guess one question is, to what extent are these accounting standards captured in taxonomies? And I understand that the development of those is ongoing, but you know, how would you characterize the current state of play?
The primary thing that had to occur, which is getting people to agree to do it, has occurred in spades.
Yeah.
Also, it just so happened that this IFRS thing, the adoption of IFRS, was happening at the same time that XBRL was trying to get adopted.
Yeah.
And they helped each other.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at a map right now, and it has a dot for every XBRL jurisdiction, and there are lots of dots.
And what's a jurisdiction?
For example, the U.S. is an XBRL jurisdiction.
Okay.
Canada is a jurisdiction. Different countries. They form an organization, typically a nonprofit organization, to basically promote XBRL in their area.
Okay.
That's what a jurisdiction is. XBRL has been adopted. It is beyond the stage of saying that it will be a global standard. You can say with a straight face that it is a global standard.
Mm-hmm.
No competition. It's being used in the U.S., in Canada, in Europe, in China.
Well, so the question is, for example, in the world of XML, there is a level of well-formedness, right? And then there's the level of schema validation. Now, as a matter of fact, you know, the vast amount of actual usage of XML, even to this day, depends on well-formedness, but not necessarily schema validation, right? There's been, I think it's fair to say that the technology is way ahead of actual use in the realm of XML schema. So, you know, analogously, I'm just imagining that there are, if you will, sort of well-formedness aspects of XBRL, you know, which, for example, would satisfy some of the kinds of exchange requirements that Brian was talking about early on, right? And which are kinds of things which any old XML dialect could handle. And then there are the what would be analogous to schema, but in your case, you know, more aiming at higher level concepts and relationships. What you call business semantics, or what I guess I call business semantics, right? And so, you know, the question is kind of like, we're obviously going to be somewhere on that continuum, and it's a moving target, but where are we now on that continuum?
Okay, so first of all, the way you characterize that is very good. I like the way you characterize this, and basically it helps understand what XML is and what XBRL is.
Yeah.
So first off, you know, where is... Let me package a lot of things together, and then we can... I'll get to what... The question I think that you're asking, I want to do a couple things here, though, to kind of set the stage here. So,
First
of all, the XBRL specification, it's there. It's usable right now. It's very solid. It works. It's been proven to work. It's been put into use. Hopefully, we can talk about the FDIC project. There's a lot more to do. It's endless. It's a bottomless pit of what you can do because there's just a lot of semantics in business.
Yes.
So basically, XBRL is a natural extension of XML. XML provides syntactic validation. And as I understand it, I could be wrong about this, but I think that I'm correct. It's been confirmed a number of times, but I'm not a technical person. I don't necessarily grasp this totally yet, but as I understand it, XML schema, again, only provides syntactic validation, not semantic validation. It's very hard to get people to understand XBRL because they don't understand the difference between syntax and semantics. So to give you an example, again, working on your question and giving examples along the way here. So first off, the biggest thing that had to be achieved is to create the XBRL specification. That is a tremendous piece of work, took time. However, there's something that was actually even bigger than that, in my view. I could be wrong about this, but this is my view. That the taxonomies themselves are of more value than the XBRL specification.
Absolutely.
It took far more effort to get these countries to agree that they want to do this and that this is the taxonomy. If you look at international financial reporting standards, you know, you can build only one taxonomy. Okay, and getting people to agree on what that taxonomy was a very difficult thing. There was far more intellectual capital that went into creating the taxonomies than creating the XBRL specification.
When you look for those, where do you look and what do you find? In other words, what's the mapping, if you will, from XBRL taxonomies to the rules defined by GAAP and IFRS?
Very good question. So I am going to use the IFRS example. The U.S. example is parallel, but it's more complicated because in the U.S., there's a whole bunch of books. There's a thing called GAAP.
Uh-huh.
It's called the House of GAAP. And you have the SEC, and you have the FASB, and you have all these different books. And it's actually a little bit of a mess right now because it's all over the place. And they're actually trying to take all those things and create one book of GAAP.
Okay.
So I'm going to use the IFRS because it's a little bit easier to understand.
Okay.
But it's exactly the same concept. There is a thing called the ISB, the International Accounting Standards Board. They get together and they agree on accounting standards, basically. And what they do is they take these accounting standards and they put it into a book. I have one sitting in my hand right now. It's about 3 inches thick. It's released about every year. And it basically has all of the accounting standards in it.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything in the book has to be put into a taxonomy. For example, there are a lot of measurement rules. How do you measure something? You know, mm-hmm. How do you measure, say, property, plant, equipment? Okay, that does not need to be in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sorry, in the taxonomy. It's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
In the taxonomy, what is important are all the things that you're required to present in a financial statement or all the things that you're required to disclose in a financial statement. Presentation means that it needs to be on the primary financial statement itself. So, for example, you're required to disclose property, plant, and equipment on the balance sheet. Okay. The disclosures are things that are in the notes to the financial statement, the explanatory disclosures. So, for example, you're required to disclose the accounting policies for each class of property, plant, and equipment.
Uh-huh.
You're required to disclose the value of each class of property, plant, and equipment, etc. The concepts in a taxonomy are defined by financial reporting standards.
Yeah, it's a declarative rule set, really, right?
Okay. I don't know what that is, but I guess that sounds right.
Yeah, well, declarative in the sense that it's a set of assertions,
yes,
which
yes.
are interrelated and which can be validated by
correct.
An automatic process. And so, you know, the authors of one of the documents that you pointed me to, which is kind of comparing XML to XBRL, makes this point, which is that XBRL is, among other things, when implemented, something that has a rules engine associated with it, right? That
absolutely.
Will process these declarations.
Absolutely. And that rules engine, XBRL will have a way of expressing business rules. There will be a processing model, I believe it's called, within the specification. So people, they can create their own rules engine, but it needs to operate in the same way and give the same answers.
Mm-hmm. So now, that's actually not part of what's there now? Or is it?
It's being built. Okay, there are rules engines that are built and working. For example, UV Matrix has one.
Yeah.
But they're working on the global specification for this. It's been in the works for a number of years. There have been a number of drafts of this. But again, there's been other priorities. But it is absolutely in the works. It's a public working draft right now. There are implementations of it, but it's not a recommendation at this
point. It's not part of the 2.1 spec that I just looked through. Okay.
No.
All right.
So these concepts in the taxonomy are referenced to the literature. So it's actually the literature, the accounting standards, that define what the concepts are in the taxonomy. Okay. You can also put instructions, or you could actually take the entire, they call it the IFRS bound volume, and put that in the form of a taxonomy.
Mm-hmm.
The bound volume is already in XML, and there will likely be cross-references from XBRL to the bound volume, so you can basically traverse back and forth. I mean, it only makes sense.
Yeah.
In the taxonomy, you can also express relationships that must exist. So, for example, if you take the classes of property, plant, equipment, for example, land, buildings, furniture and fixtures, other, and you add those up, they better add up to the total of property, plant, and equipment on your balance sheet. So that's a rule that can be expressed in the taxonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are boatloads of rules. If you're an accountant or someone that understands financial statements, if you look at it, I used to work for Pricewaterhouse. And one of the things that I would have to do when a financial statement was going out, sit there at my desk with a 10 key and go over the entire financial statement with my 10 key, my red pencil, and my green eye shades, and then tick and tie everything and make sure that everything added up. Then what would typically happen is then the partner would come over and say, we've got to make an adjustment. So then what I would have to do is then go and make that adjustment in the financial statement. But when, say, you change net income by $10, that changes a lot of things on the financial statement, because net income impacts the balance sheet because it makes retained earnings go up. It impacts the statement of equity because the net income goes through the statement of equity, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, imagine to be able to post a transaction to a financial statement, press a button, and then everything updates automatically. Wow. You can do that with XBRL.
You need a calculation engine going on here too.
We have that.
In something that I read today. Oh, okay. In the KPMG tutorial. Here's the example. You have a lease for a building. It's used by two subsidiaries. The report will split the expense of the lease 40% to subsidiary A, 60% to B, right? And then they kind of walk you through at the XBR level what you would do to implement that arrangement. And so you have to create three concepts, one for the building, one for the subsidiary A, one for the B, those two expenses. Then for each expense, there are two calculation arcs, one going child to parent, one going parent to child, with weights attached to them and so on and so forth, right? And it actually kind of walks you through the raw XBRL for doing that, right? And it's pretty verbose, right? As at that level, necessarily it has to be.
What do you mean, what is verbose?
Well, so the XML itself, right? There's an X-link locator for each element and so on, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff there, right?
Yeah, and how many times do you use the lower-level language inside Microsoft Excel to actually use Excel?
That's actually what I'm trying to get to here, is the assumption is that there are going to be not only XBRL processors that can validate this stuff and can transform the stuff into the reports that people see, but there are also going to be data modeling tools, if you will, interactive data modeling tools, which enable people with a business view of the world to express these concepts in languages and using tools and interfaces, which are going to look very different from the raw guts of the XBRL. And so it would be interesting to hear a little bit more. I mean, I've been poking around. One of the questions I had was, well, how many XBRL processors are there in the world? I mean, there's the sort of list of products and services page at, I guess, the XBRL website, and it lists a number of different things. I think they're in different categories, though. I think that the UB Matrix tool, the Blast Radius tool, I think the DecisionSoft tool, I mean, there's a couple that are clearly in the category of, this is probably a complete suite of things, which is a processor and a validator and a bunch of interactive modeling and analysis tools wrapped around that, right? And then there are others which are more sort of point solutions for reporting or for data entry, right?
All these applications that you mentioned, for example, UbiMatrix, DecisionSoft, Fujitsu, Hitachi,
yeah,
they all have these applications that you pointed out, but they also have X-Rail processors.
Okay.
They're separate products typically.
Okay, so there might be on the order of more than a dozen, less than, let's say, 30 independent implementations of what we would call an XBRL processor.
Correct.
In the world today. Now,
correct.
I'm just curious, are there test suites, you know, validators for those things?
Absolutely.
Okay.
There's a conformance suite, and that's one of the things that I've been working on for the past, you know, years for all these different things that we have. We have the XBRL 2.1 conformance suite. We have extensions to that, such as financial reporting taxonomies architecture, which is basically an additional specification that goes above and beyond XBRL for these big, robust financial reporting taxonomies.
Yeah.
We have XBRL dimensions, which is a multidimensional analysis way to express multidimensional analysis information in XBRL. There's a conformance suite for that. There'll be a conformance suite for XBRL formulas.
And if I look on XBRL.org, will I find someplace, this, you know, I mean, typically you find a page someplace where there's a matrix of the available products and their performance on the test suite, their levels of conformance to the standard. Is that out there somewhere?
I don't know that has been done. It's actually been talked about.
Okay.
You know, XBRL International is a nonprofit organization. In my view, the websites could be better organized, but mm-hmm. and maybe it will. When people demand it enough, it will. But the information about these processors is out there. If you want to get it, you can get it.
So what's your sense then of the degree to which the range of products that's out there now is or is not a, you know, complete and reliable implementation of the standard?
I know quite well, let's say, 4 or 5 products.
Uh-huh.
These are typically the people that participate in the XBRL specification group. And so we're working together to, you know, create our applications and create the specification.
Okay.
So I can speak to those processors. There are plenty of very high-quality XBRL processors. The more important thing is that these processors are very interoperable. So, you know, in the early days of HTML, when you went use one browser, you got something that showed up one way, and you use a different browser, it showed up a different way.
Mm-hmm. And this interop is validated by your test suite?
By the conformance suite,
by the
correct.
Conformance suite, yeah, okay.
So, again, I'm a CPA. I create real-life uses of XBRL. What that does is it helps us figure out how to build the XBRL specification, and it gives us good test cases to see if XBRL is meeting the needs of the users.
Okay. So you said somewhere, it was in, I think, an interview that I found a link to, you said CPAs owe it to themselves, their clients and employers, to develop a basic competency in XBRL. And I would be interested to know what that means. I mean, I think it's got to mean different things depending on your role. I mean, you might be someone who is engaged in the translation of IFRS rules into XBRL taxonomies, you know, so there's sort of one level of expertise that's needed there, and also related to that, a potential range of tool support that's needed. You know, then there's, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, right, there's the exchange and reporting aspect of it, and as you talked about way back at the beginning, the perspective as a preparer, which is one you know, different from either of those, right? So, you know, kind of, can you kind of sketch out, like, what are the different relationships that people in this world are going to have to XBRL? What are the kinds of skills that will be necessary in those roles, and what are the kinds of tools that will be supporting the people who are in those different roles?
Number one, the Gartner Group defined XBRL as a transformational technology. What they define transformational as enables new ways of doing business across industries that will result in major shifts in industry dynamics. Okay, I agree with the Gartner Group. It is not the case that XBRL will be a little piece plugged in to accounting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it will transform accounting like it has never been transformed before, except for when they invented the debit and credit, most likely. If you look at accounting, it has changed very little in 500 years. The spreadsheet, you know, moved things from a paper spreadsheet into electronic spreadsheets.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, most accountants, they're still spreadsheets. You know, they like Excel because it's amazing what people build in Excel.
It sure is.
Most of the time, they should be using relational databases to build it. But this, you know, there's a thing people refer to it as spreadsheet hell.
Yep.
Okay, you know what another thing they call that? Enron. Okay, the reason that Enron, or a reason, it's impossible to have an audit trail from based on spreadsheets.
Yep.
Can't do
yep.
it. The second thing is accountants are seen as, you know, business advisors, and or they want to be seen as business advisors. A lot of times they're not very good business advisors because they don't understand business, and they've been criticized for that.
Hmm.
If you want to be a good business advisor, you need to know about things before the people that you are advising. So it's a good thing to learn about XBRL so you can basically have an informed opinion about, you know, what's going to happen here. It's rare that you find an accountant that doesn't understand that has not heard the term XBRL.
Yeah.
However, you know, I give presentations, and you know, I ask the audience, like, so do people, are they comfortable with understanding what XBRL is? And the typical answer is no. Understanding XBRL is an important thing because the signs are that XBRL will impact lots of things about financial reporting, accounting.
Yeah, but I'm kind of back to, well, so what would it mean to understand XBRL? And that would in turn depend on where I sit in the scheme of things, right? So it would mean one thing if I'm trying to translate financial rules into taxonomies. It would be mean another thing if I'm trying to understand how to utilize XBRL formatted reports that are on the web. It'd be another thing if I'm an accountant working with a client and in fact we're engaged in really a data modeling exercise, right, where I'm trying to map what's going on in his or her business to I'm trying to extract the semantics out of what they've got and map that into this. And so, you know, and then, you know, related to those different rules, again, there are going to be different kinds of tools, right? And I'm trying to get a sense of, like, if we can just enumerate what those broad types would be and give some examples.
And let me add another dynamic to this, and that is, because I totally agree with your statement, and you're correct. The other dynamic here is the state of software.
Yep.
Software for XBRL is not mature, not very mature, at the user level. At the XBRL processor level, it's very mature. That's where people have been making their investments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where UMatrix has been making its investments,
mm-hmm.
building out a robust infrastructure and architecture on which to build. Okay, so the user, and partially because that's what people are buying right now, the user's tools for doing a lot of things that they're going to be doing it's either non-existent or very, very immature.
Mm-hmm.
And the learning that is required is really directly related to the tools. The better the tools, the more complexity that the tools hide, and therefore the less that the user has to know.
Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like, so the question is, well, better at what? You know, better at modeling,
right,
better at...
I'll get to that now.
Yeah.
To that now. So basically, there are a number of things that people are going to be doing. So number one, and a relatively complex thing, is basically building these large base taxonomies like IFRS, US GAAP, and there'll be others, large taxonomies. It's kind of like equivalent to the person that builds a database schema. So it's similar skills. You're not every user of an application. It's not necessary that they know how to build a database application.
Mm-hmm.
They just know how to, you know, use the interface. Mm-hmm. So at one level, you know, for accountants, using financial reporting as an example, accountants need to understand XBRL taxonomies intimately because they need to make sure that they are expressing the accounting standards that they are expressing correctly using XBRL.
So then my exact question here is, do you think that they're going to be understanding those taxonomies in terms of the underlying XML syntax, or are they going to be understanding them in terms of some intermediate higher level representation? And if so, what is that representation going to be, and what's its relationship to tooling?
Okay, again, that's a very good question. Are they going to be dealing with XML syntax? No. Okay, do they have to deal with XML syntax now? Yeah. You know, because I mean, I get in there and have to dink around with stuff at the XML level to build taxonomies correctly right now, because the tools are not quite where they need to be. Plus, I just experiment a lot, and I know it at that level. Sometimes it's easier for me to do it in Notepad than it is in a tool because, you know, I had to help build it, so I understand it intimately.
Yeah.
Others, they're not going to do that. And they don't. You can build some fairly sophisticated taxonomies now just with the tools that exist, it's good. You still have to have more knowledge than you really should have down the road, or you have to have more knowledge now than you will have to have down the road. But it's not bad right now. I've successfully taught people to build taxonomies, and they've had no prior XBRL knowledge, and they built some fairly complex taxonomies.
Right. Well, kind of to Carol Brown's point, let's remember that we're dealing with a group of people who are, for a living, accustomed to dealing with stunningly, mind-blowingly complex forms and documents.
Right.
And so, there's a...
Right. And again, they're doing this stuff now. So that's one level, building these large base taxonomies. I've got a degree in accounting, and I've got 10 years, 15 years of experience in accounting. I assure you that it takes far more effort to understand financial reporting than it does to understand XBRL. I can teach you XBRL in a month. So you can't build a good financial reporting taxonomy unless you've got a tremendous amount of financial reporting expertise. So, and the accountants have that. The second thing is you will have people extending these taxonomies. So for example, if Microsoft is releasing their financials using the U.S. GAAP taxonomy, it's not quite what they want to do because in the U.S. you have some flexibility in how you report, so they basically tweak the taxonomy a little bit. You're going to have a bit of skill to be able to tweak that taxonomy. Not nearly as much skill as creating the base taxonomy, but you have to know a little bit about XBRL.
One thing that occurs to me again on the analogy to XML is that there are a number of different XML schema languages. So, for example, XML schema itself, which is used by XBRL, and in fact, as I understand it, an XBRL taxonomy document is an instance of XML schema, right?
Correct.
But there is an alternative syntax called RelaxNG.
Yep, and there's also RDF, OWL.
That's another whole can of worms. But just in terms of the idea that with the Relax syntax for expressing a schema, you have something which is, let's say, more readable and writable but semantically equivalent. Are there going to be...
The users are never going to have to deal with this.
They're doing it now, right?
Well, two things. Number one, Relax did not exist when we started to create XML.
Right.
XBRL. In fact, XML schema didn't even exist when we started to create XML.
Right. Well, I'm not asking whether XBRL should use Relax versus XML schema. It's more a question of, is there an analog to Relax that could or should or will exist in the XBRL world? In other words, a way of writing taxonomies, which is, let's say, just more concise and more readable.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't see any need because
They're
not going to be using the... One of the major drawbacks of XML is that you can read it. That may seem really, really odd, But the problem is that, like you were talking about those link bases. People, when they look at these link bases and they freak out, and they should. When I looked at a link base for the first time, I freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that it doesn't matter. What matters is that those link bases, they're a global standard, okay? They're issued by the W3C. We didn't make it up.
Mm-hmm.
We could have created a far simpler method of expressing that information,
mm-hmm.
most likely. It probably would have been inferior to XLink. Some aspects would have been more superior, but it would have been inferior because it wasn't a global standard, just some more stuff we had to write in XBRL.
Mm-hmm.
So we could have also not used XML schema as the base.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but there's a lot of things that XLink give us, and there's a lot of things that XML schema give us. And the bottom line, truth be told, it makes no difference. It's just syntax.
Mm-hmm.
And down the road, when the software is hiding all these things, we're not going to be having discussions about whether we should be using XML schema or whether we should have a simpler, more concise way of doing this. We're not going to be discussing that. So it's not really relevant, in my view.
I hope that That's true. I would have to observe that in my experience, and I've seen this cycle repeated several times over the last 15 or more years, that invariably, so far, in my experience, the tools will sweep the complexity under the rug argument ends up being undermined to some extent. And the thing that you alluded to earlier, you know, the fact that to this day, you know, you're inclined to open up Notepad and work on this stuff,
yep,
is, you know, there's something important there that, you know, I think we dismiss at our peril. And I'm not trying to say that I'm not for insulating people from this stuff with tools,
yep,
and providing levels of abstraction and so forth and so on. But they're how shall I put this?
I'm totally with you, and you're not the only person making this statement.
Uh-huh.
You know, a really good example is SQML.
Yes.
Compared to XML.
Exactly.
What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, no, Charlie, in fact, you know, not long ago mentioned that. I think that's an excellent parallel to this, that, you know, if it weren't for SGML, XML never would have come about by, you know, sort of the developer's own words. And, you know, it's possible that XBRL will evolve into something that's, you know, simpler and more ubiquitous. The thing is that I think today XBRL, as it's spec'd out, does have such wide use on an international basis that it already has good strong roots in the ground. And so simpler tools always can come about for processing the stuff, whether it's XML or SGML. But I do think that's a really good you know, description, analogy to draw.
Well, another point that Carol Brown made, which I think is extremely relevant in this context, is that there is a perhaps unprecedented top-down imperative to make this stuff happen, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's a different case. I mean, in, you know, the web and HTML and in many ways XML all arose really from the grassroots, and we're never sort of mandated by international governments in the way that this stuff is. And so, you know, there's a sense in which that's a wild card here that we haven't kind of seen before in other technology deployments that we might like to draw analogies to.
It may be the case that XBRL evolves. It is not the case that XBRL is going to go away.
Right.
It could be the case that through use, some things are deemed not necessary. And in my view, there are things that could be cut from XBRL to make it simpler. Not a whole bunch. We did that partially when we went from XBRL 2.0 to 2.1. But XBRL is not going away. It could be made simpler, and if that's the case, then fine, we'll just evolve it. This would be a very good time to talk about the FDIC.
Okay.
Here are some observations that I've made over the years. So I know a lot about the FDIC project. My company, EB Matrix, helped implement that project, and I gave the FDIC the very first demo of what XBRL was to try and, you know, get them to become a member of the consortium, myself and a gentleman from KPMG.
And what is the project that you're referring to?
Their call report modernization project,
okay,
which went live last October.
Okay.
But this started a long, long time ago, 2001, when the FDIC came to the London Conference of XBRL International to find out more about XBRL.
Mm-hmm.
And they learned about XBRL. They thought that it had possibilities, so they wanted to help support the standard and, you know, keep checking and see if there's something they could do here. So along the way, we did a little prototype. Then I helped them build the taxonomy models, and then I gave them some training, and we ended up building a prototype, which is probably one of the coolest projects I've ever worked on in my life. It was like one of those projects where everything like clicks. I learned a lot, and we built the prototype. The prototype was used to sell the people that had to approve the FDIC project, and clearly it worked. It sold them. They began implementing the project. You know, again, they went live October of last year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is not the case that they went from, you know, a paper-based system to an electronic system.
Right.
They already had an electronic system.
Right.
It is not the case that the electronic system was like PDF or HTML. It was tagged data. It was just tagged in a proprietary format.
Right.
And here's the FDIC, who already had a system, wanting to change to a different electronic system.
Right.
Okay. It is the case that there are a lot of people out there that either they already have electronic systems, and I've heard this argument over, you know, over and over. It's like, well, we don't need XBRL because we already have a system.
Mm-hmm.
I get that argument a lot, and I can typically show them why what they have is not superior to what they could have if they would have, you know, if they implement XBRL. But many times they don't need to change because it's there, it's working. Another thing, though, is that there are many people that could not implement any type of system like XBRL because it was so bloody expensive. There are tons of people that are out there exchanging data. It happens all the time.
Yep.
Commonly, this data is unstructured. A lot of these stock exchanges exchange data in PDF. And it's amazing.
It's frightening.
So the FDIC, let me give you some statistics here. In, let's see, I think it was June or July of 2005, the FDIC accepted their last filings under the old, you know, format, the old way of doing it,
mm-hmm.
in July. In October, they accepted their first XBRL filing.
Mm-hmm.
In the very last filing in their old system, there were 18,000 errors in the data that was received from the, I think it was 9,000 some odd filers.
Mm-hmm.
18,000 errors.
Mm-hmm.
In the first filing using the XBRL system, there were zero errors. So you're saying, you know, that's not possible. You can't do that. Okay, well, it is possible. Let me explain why it's possible and the ramifications of that.
Well, it's possible because you have validation.
Exactly.
Technology.
Well, they had validation before, but the problem with the validation is that it was run on the FDIC mainframes, and the software applications that were used to create the data did not have access to those business rules.
Mm-hmm.
Simply making those business rules accessible is what made the error level go from 18,000 down to zero.
Right.
Now, what was the impact?
So, in other words, the preparing software and the accepting software were synchronized on the same
exactly.
set of validation rules.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So now, what did that mean in human terms? Okay, the FDIC had a staff of 126 people. Whenever they had an error, they would pick up the phone, they would call the bank, say, excuse me, your balance sheet doesn't add up, you might like to fix that. And then the people would resubmit their filing, and they would continue to do that until all the errors were corrected.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that they had to wait 90 days before they could post that data to their website and make it available because they had to correct all the errors.
So you're saying that long delay loop was because this was a serial process? In other words, it would cough out
exactly.
one error, cough out the next one, and every one of those was a round trip?
Something like that. But basically, you had humans involved in validating it because they could not automate the process. With XBRL, they automated that process from very beginning to very end.
Right.
And the FDIC doesn't care how the banks create the information, but they're responsible for creating it.
Right.
So, but that was the problem that the software vendors solved. But you know what it meant in terms of savings of personnel is pretty clear to see.
So, what would be some of the applications that were used on the preparer side to produce those reports sent to the FDIC?
The same applications that were used in the old system. They're just the vendors updated their software to use rather than the proprietary format that the FDIC created and spent millions of dollars creating.
Mm-hmm.
They simply converted that to XBRL.
Well, but that's not just a simple thing because it implies that now their software has, number one, mapped its internal concepts to XBRL taxonomy, and number two, that either interactively during preparation or in batch mode post-preparation, there's been an XBRL-style validation performed on the stuff. So
actually, it's a little bit different than that. Here's
okay.
why.
Okay.
In the past, you know how those software applications received metadata that would drive their applications? For example, the concepts,
mm-hmm.
the instructions
mm-hmm.
for the concepts, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they would typically get some of the information in PDF form, some of it in Excel form, some of it in Microsoft Word form.
Mm-hmm.
The FDIC standardized all that information in XBRL.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that they wanted to do is to update the data that was collected. They wanted to make it more flexible. It was very difficult to change their systems and the vendors to change their software because it was not standardized and there was not a method for doing it. They hadn't thought of a method for, you know, adding a concept or removing a concept. So the data was static.
Mm-hmm.
And now one of the things that they wanted to achieve was the ability to change that data on a monthly basis if they wanted to, and they can do that now.
I've never filed an FDIC report. Let's put some names to these applications just so I have a context here. You know, what's a well-known application that I would be using on the preparer side of this deal?
Well, these are specific applications for doing FDIC filings. There, and I don't have the names. There's a company called Shezhnov. I think
okay.
They're one of the leaders.
Okay. So these are not being done in tweaked versions of Microsoft Office or anything like that.
No, but the thing is, you could very easily do that in Office if you wanted to. You could build your own application quite easily. Because a lot of the work is done in the XBRL rules engine and the other XBRL validators. There will be a time when the specialized versions of software, for example, the FDIC filing software and then the filing software used for the NAIC, for the insurance, They're all just proprietary. What that does is it basically locks the user in to a high-cost software application.
Mm-hmm.
The software was written correctly, and it leveraged XBRL. All you do is you change the metadata, and then you could reconfigure the system for an FDIC filing or an NAIC filing or a Bank of Belgium filing.
Right. No, yeah, I get that. So for example, I noted that there is a Microsoft Excel XBRL add-in of some sort. It's, I guess, a beta or a prototype at this point. For example, what does that thing do? What is the scope of it? Is it something that you would describe as an XBRL processor, or is it an interface that produces XBRL well-formed output that would need to be validated by an external processor? How does that thing?
It's the second thing.
It's the second thing? Okay.
All it did was basically allowed the users to put in data, and then it would output XML. You have to still have a validator. They didn't build a validator.
Okay.
If you talk to people in the XBRL community, no one would disagree that one day there is going to be an open source public.
I was just going to ask about that. It's an obvious thing.
Yeah, well, thanks, Charlie, for actually bringing that up. And, John, I'm glad it was on your mind, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Recently, when the SEC had sort of an open comment for looking at how XBRL and interactive data could be used in the financial services area, in mutual funds and so forth, I did send in a letter, and I basically advocated on behalf of the utilization of open source at sort of the engine level,
mm-hmm.
so that it could, because it's like reinventing the wheel somewhat,
exactly.
as I look at
exactly.
it. And so I think we're probably on the same page with this, that, you know, if you get an open source engine out there, then suddenly not only do you get more people who have access to it, who can, you know, learn from it and get educated by it, but also who can build atop a standard, hopefully standard set of, you know, APIs or functionality.
Well, and what I would add is that, you know, what you really don't need is for DecisionSoft and UB Matrix and Blast Radius and everybody else to be putting a lot of energy into core engines. Because where you want all that creativity and differentiation to occur is at the level of, I mean, there's a whole range of tools, you know, for, like we said, you know, for different roles, different responsibilities, different use cases, you know, and that's where you want the energy to go.
Yeah. How much fun would it be if everybody that wanted to use XML had to build their own XML parser?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I hope that's a message that gets out to the leading XBRL processors, that they can see that it's not only in the market's interest, but in their own interest, you know, in terms of ongoing maintenance and development and resource allocation, that there's an opportunity out there for people to kind of step forward and turn in this direction in a very productive and fruitful way.
So the fact that we're having this discussion says that, however, there's been no movement yet in that direction.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
I could point you to a site. I think it's xbrlopen.com, or I can send you the link on it.
Okay.
Basically, there are two entries in it that are open source. In one case, it's a Java-based API that more or less is at the, you know, blueprint architectural level design. There's another. They are now really in the second generation of it. It has been deployed previously
And I'll just leave it at least one exchange, the early incarnation of this, in one global significant market exchange in the world. And they're now working on a next generation of it. And I personally have had interactions with several different sources who, in this same way, whom I have contacted and said, wouldn't it be good to have an open source implementation of this stuff? And would you be, you know, willing, interested, and able to participate in terms of contributing code or engineering talents and so forth? And so right now, I would say, just based upon my discussions, there is interest. You know, it's not the kind of thing where we have seen, as we've seen with IBM, the contribution of the Eclipse code base, for instance, to the open source community. Or it's not the case where we've seen Oracle really, you know, an active leading participant in the next generation of open source code. But will we? Hopefully, and hopefully with some of your reporting and coverage, it'll come sooner rather than later. One other thing, I believe that time is right for an XBRL Olympics. Referring back to, John, your question about, you know, what does the matrix of available processors look like? Who are the players? What's the performance? What's the functionality? What's the interoperability? These are all great questions. And until you sort of address these questions and have clarity around the answers, it becomes more difficult for people to move forward. One other thing I just wanted to say as well, and you know, you'd mentioned earlier on about the sort of the data modeling, and does this move us, you know, will there be tools, will there be, I think that the availability, the spec of XBRL makes the possibility of data modeling just moves it to an entirely new level. You know, Charlie's story about sort of, you know, working through the tying out the different numbers with the green, you know, the green eye shades, the whole bit, and the partner coming over and make this change here, and we got to get it over to the balance sheet. I think with the XBRL, one of the main movers behind this is it moves that whole to a whole new level of possibility, which I liken to honestly back in the days when Dan Bricklin first conceived of what a spreadsheet could do. You probably know the apocryphal tale that is told that, you know, he's sitting in a classroom at the Harvard Business School, working through these, you know, this endless presentation of these green sheets that people would, you know, have. And they do a what if, you know, what if sales go up 10%? What if operating expenses go up 10%? What, and they'd have to manually go through and recalculate all these things. And so he was like, boy, we've got, you know, the computers are there, let's do something with it. And now, in that classroom at Harvard Business School, there is a plaque, a gold plaque, that acknowledges the contribution that Dan Bricklin made to, you know, in the conception of the spreadsheet. I think the same thing is due for, I think XBRL and the innovation that it has brought forth is on the same level of magnitude of what the spreadsheet brought to the industry. So, to me, that is, I think, the potential impact that this has on business process, on information technology, on business reporting, and it's moving along pretty fast, and it's mature. It's taken a long time because of the taxonomy development and the, you know, the participation and buy-in of all these different government agencies. But the FDIC example is a tremendous success story. From what I've been told by somebody who worked on the project, they subsequently, from the FDIC in the U.S., had discussions with people in Japan. The Japan banking system has adopted XBRL in similar ways. There's been knowledge that has been leveraged between the developers who worked on these projects and the agencies, and it's a very promising time, I think. So thanks for that. I apologize for...
No, I think this was excellent. Personally, I got a lot out of this, and I think that the three of us on this call, I think, represent a useful set of perspectives. We're kind of triangulating on this stuff, because this is one of those situations like I'm seeing happen a lot right now as the worlds of IT and business try to kind of grapple with one another and come to a new arrangement. you just get these interesting effects when people who are coming primarily from tech and people who are coming primarily from business and accounting are trying to sort of understand one another's terminologies, and this is at that intersection, and that's what makes it so interesting.
One of the things is this XBRL really did come out of the accounting community, and the long history of it is, I think, pretty well documented. In the early days, anyway, certainly the software industry, you know, was certainly not leading and was not, practically speaking, participating. I mean, if we think of the software industry as we know it over the past, you know, decade or 15 years. And so it's not surprising, I guess, in some sense, that there's been somewhat of a lack earlier on of state-of-the-art tools as the software industry went after different markets in different areas. But I do think, the bridges are being built, the communities are coming together. There's a lot more communication, certainly, over the past years than there has been earlier on. But I do think that in some ways it's like, you know, building a house that you know, sometimes the foundation takes kind of a long time. You got to break ground, you got to pour the forms in and pour it. Takes time, but you know, once you get that strong, solid foundation in, suddenly the thing just, you know, it goes right up. And I think an awful lot of what has been done is getting the foundation and getting the frame in place.
So, I'd like to add to that also. XBRL International gets a lot of compliments for what they've been able to create in a relatively short time when you look at how, you know, global standards tend to operate.
Yeah.
And there have been some reasons for that. You know, it is true that the accounting profession started this. I mean, I worked for a little CPA firm in Tacoma, Washington, and dinked around with some stuff. And I read a book on XML, and it's like, this is a no-brainer. This is an absolute no-brainer. And I really don't really understand why people say, oh, it's this profound thing that, you know, impacts the entire world. It's like, I did the obvious.
When was that, by the way? When
did you? 1998.
Okay.
My small firm, I went in to ask them if I could do this, and they were like, we don't have time for this stuff. I was fairly productive there, and they cut me some slack. And it was because of another person, Wayne Harding. He had good ties at the AICPA, and he's a salesman. So he helped me basically get into the AICPA and get them to understand that they should do this.
Okay.
And it is one thing, you know, after another to make XBRL what it is. And I get, you know, I get a lot of credit. You know, people call me the father of XBRL, and I'll accept that. I started the whole thing. I'm the guy that did the obvious. But in my view, there's a lot of technical people that are not getting the credit that they deserve for actually creating something that I think is pretty brilliant. I didn't really understand XBRL. And one of the dynamics that really helped XBRL, I believe, is there were enough technical people, for example, Walter Hampshire was one, who really struggled to understand what the domain was trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
He struggled and learned, and I don't know if he struggled. I mean, I just sort of assumed that he struggled because I struggled to learn the technical stuff. But Ralph was a pretty smart guy. And there was a dynamic where, you know how you mentioned that, you know, a lot of times the business world and the IT world grapple on how to communicate?
Yeah.
Well, we had a little bit of that in XBRL, but we effectively worked it out, and I think we created a pretty good product as a result pretty fast. I do want to say one more time, though, that there's just a lot of brilliant work that went in, I believe, to creating XBRL. And, you know, I hope that some of these guys get credit for what they've been able to accomplish. I think it's good. I think it's good stuff.
Well, I see it from two very different points of view. I mean, you know, part of me is a total XML geek. And so I can go to that place and I can get really excited about all of those possibilities. And then, you know, part of me is very cognizant of what actually sticks to the wall. And that was the aspect that came out in that InfoWorld column. My repeated observation that what sticks to the wall very often winds up being not very closely related to the elegant thing that was designed and built. And that what, in the end, if you can, you like to get to is a situation in which there's more iteration back and forth. That the partial solutions are able to deliver enough value to get out there and to be used to accomplish certain things, and that through the use of them, more is discovered about requirements, and, you know, you turn the crank again. And so I'll admit I have a bias at this point against technical projects that require massive amounts of foundation building before the first user ever files a report using the system. But I try to be open-minded and not dogmatic about things. And so despite feeling that way in general, what I am feeling in particular about this project is that, well, you know, there are extenuating circumstances, right? And, you know, you can't just be dogmatic about these things. And so as several people pointed out in reply to the column that I wrote, well, this complexity isn't something that XBRL invented. This complexity is the complexity of the real world of business and financial reporting, and yep. you know, right? I mean, that's just a fact. So complexity is conserved, and you can't sweep that under the rug. And so the question is, what are the tools and technologies that we're going to be able to use to manage that? And it's not, you know, clearly it's not. There's no simple answer here.
Your concerns are very justifiable, and you are not the only person with these concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So let me the first XML-based financial statement was created. We had a DTD that supported the content model, and it was very similar to a standard XML document,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The content model. I saw that, and I knew that if you wanted to do this, then that's going to mean a significant change in financial reporting. And does the financial community have a palate for that? So, and this is what we're going to have to do to make this thing work.
Right.
Okay, very early, I actually talked to Tim Bray,
mm-hmm.
and I talked to Walter Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them pointed out, even before XBRL International existed, that the way that I did it won't work.
Right.
And the reason was, that's not the way financial reporting works.
Right.
There would have been a lot of people that would have been happy with the standard native XML or DTD-based or whatever you call that, the normal content model. But that's not the realities of business reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is also the case that, you know, XBRL is very modular. You can take pieces out, add pieces in, and, you know, get functionality.
Yeah, I actually had that conversation with David Von Cannon, and on the one hand, he was pointing out what you just said, and then on the other hand, he was expressing, I think, a little bit of wistful regret that more of that modular character hadn't emerged in sort of the current state of the technology.
Hadn't emerged? It should have been done later?
Well, no, that, you know, in other words, that there is the possibility of using it in a modular way, but it's not, you know, he wished that it were more, that were more obvious to readers of the specification and to implementers, you know.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
How to enable people to use the thing in an incremental, in a mode of incremental adoption.
I can agree with that. I mean, to me, it's obvious because, I mean, I helped build it.
Yeah.
But you're right. Other people, they've not seen it. So clearly, it's a potential issue.
Yeah.
But it is very modular. Just detach the link base. Don't use it. I mean, you just use a simple schema, and you get basically a very simple form of XML, plus some of the things that you must have for using numeric information. It's like, for example, what period is it?
Yeah.
What currency are you using?
Yeah. This does remind me of one other issue I wanted to discuss, and that is the one of education and training. And, you know, I saw, I think, in your interview, a desire. I mean, there's always a desire for, you know, more and better education and training. For what it's worth, my observation would be that one thing that would be really helpful is to draw out exactly what you just sketched, to make it clearer to people who want to proceed incrementally in the adoption of this stuff, that, you know, here's, you can invest this much and get this much return, and then the next level you invest this much more, and these are the benefits, right? To kind of break that out for people, I think would be extremely helpful, you know, so that it doesn't, you know, appear to be a monolith.
That's a good idea. I see what you're saying, and the information about the modularity exists, but what you're stating does not exist.
Yes.
I've not seen what you described,
yeah.
And I do agree that it would be a very good idea.
Yeah
I agree too.
Yeah. Well, great. Guys, thanks really so much for doing this. I really enjoyed this a lot, and I think that although probably your first contact with me was in a critical mode, I mean, I'm obviously, or it should be obvious, you know, deeply supportive of the objectives and also very excited about the possibilities. So, well, anyway, I'll wind up. But, you know, again, just thanks a lot. This was really good.
Great. Thanks,
John.
Okay, take care, guys.
Thanks, John.